Good evening. On behalf of the Dean and Chapter, I'm delighted to welcome you to this year's One People Oration. My name is Paul Bauman, and as well as being Receiver General of the Abbey, I currently have the pleasure of chairing the steering group for the Westminster Abbey Institute, which is hosting this evening's lecture as part of its autumn programme. It is a particular pleasure to welcome delegates from the One Young World Summit, which is taking place in London this week. It seems to me, at least, highly appropriate for a group of young leaders from around the world to take part in this year's oration, which takes as its theme the future of church and state, both here in the UK and across the wider world. You are all most welcome, and we very much look forward to hearing your perspectives in the question and answer session which will follow the lecture. This year's oration is a very special event in a number of ways. You may already be aware that the phrase "one people" was coined in 1965 by Edward Carpenter, then Archdeacon of Westminster, to serve as the theme of the year-long celebrations to mark the 900th anniversary of Edward the Confessor's Abbey Church, the second on this site. The One People initiative had at its heart the thought that the Abbey had over centuries become a place to which the peoples of the world were drawn, people of every race, colour and creed, and that it therefore had a unique opportunity, indeed a responsibility, to nurture the growth of a universal human, Christian and ecumenical consciousness, as Eric Abbott, the Dean at that time, described it. In his inaugural sermon for the year, he talked of the Abbey's commitment to promote the cause of unity in the truth, with an aspiration to foster one people in world and church. So as we come together at the end of our rather more modest but no less wonderful fortnight of celebrations for the 750th anniversary of Henry III's masterpiece, the current Abbey Church, which he built around the shrine of St. Edward the Confessor, to replace Edward's 1065 building, it's fitting that we return to this theme of the church and its relationship with a wider world which arguably needs unity in the truth rather more than ever before. Over the decades which followed the Year of One People, the annual One People Oration has covered a wide range of topics, from East-West relations to the interaction between science, politics, and poverty. And it's been delivered by a stellar cast, including the Duke of Edinburgh, prime ministers, presidents, archbishops, broadcasters, soldiers, spies, and even a couple of astronauts. This year's speaker needs little introduction, especially here at the Abbey, which he has led with great distinction over the last 13 years as its 38th dean. But if you do want to study his rich and varied CV on your way home, you have a summary on your seats. Or if you want a rather more colourful account, you can choose between recent profiles in The Guardian and The Telegraph, depending on your taste, to find out a bit more. John Hall's time at the Abbey, which comes to an end in a couple of weeks' time, has been a period of exceptional growth in the mission of the Abbey, across every dimension of its work. But the strengthening and deepening of its relationship with the institutions and leaders at the heart of our national life has undoubtedly been a particular hallmark, if you'll pardon the pun. The most immediate demonstration of this is, of course, the Westminster Abbey Institute itself, founded in 2013 with a mission to help revitalise moral and spiritual values in public life and service. As many of you will be aware, the Institute runs an annual season of public lectures and symposia, of which you'll hear a bit more later on. The year-long fellowship programmes for aspiring public service leaders now have 100 alumni occupying strategic roles across the public sector, and 20 more have recently embarked on their journey with us over the coming year. And we also facilitate private seminars for government departments and other organisations seeking a safe space to explore challenging issues through the lens of moral values. These are all small, but nonetheless significant practical examples of the sort of synergy between church and state that we'll be exploring on a much broader national and international canvas this evening. And there is no better guide to this topic, from its frequently troubled historical evolution to its critical role in our shared futures, than John Hall. So without further ado, I'll invite you to give him a very warm welcome for his lecture on faith at the heart of nations. Thank you.
Westminster Abbey is unique in the world. There are many churches and cathedrals in the world, some of which are more beautiful, more ancient, more glorious than Westminster Abbey. Think, for example, only in this country of Durham Cathedral, squatting magnificently on its rocky promontory high over the city of Durham, overlooking the wide reaches of its county, alongside the castle also built by William the Conqueror in the 11th century. Think of the great cathedral in Canterbury, with its sinuous extension and beautiful glass, and of York Minster, with its magnificent bulk and breadth, each dominating their city and county. And think beyond of France, of Amiens Cathedral, its nave soaring 10 meters higher than the nave of the Abbey. Think, anyway, of more obvious great churches, St. Peter's Basilica, Notre Dame in Paris, soon to be restored, we hope. So many churches, cathedrals, abbeys, each splendid and magnificent in its own way, but none compares with Westminster Abbey. These are not just the sentimental maunderings of a man approaching old age and retirement after almost 13 years of dedication to the ministry and mission of the Abbey. It is simply the case that no other church or cathedral or abbey in the world has this particular mixture of attributes. Westminster Abbey continues to be a living church with 28 acts of worship each week, 8 of them sung by the Abbey's choir. The Abbey continues to be the place of coronation of the kings and queens of England, Great Britain, and the United Kingdom. The Abbey houses the graves and memorials of many of the kings and queens of this country from 1066 until 1760, and many of the greatest men and women of our national life and international connection. You see their graves around us on the floor, 3,500, 4,000 altogether. And the Abbey has attracted around it the Palace of Westminster, and much more recently added to the mix the government and state offices, and in 2009, the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom Judiciary. Nowhere in the world, I believe, is such a national and state community clustered around a great church. We have an 11th century king to thank for what the Abbey has become. Edward reigned in England before Duke William of Normandy's conquest of this country in 1066. He was king from 1042 until his death on the 5th of January, 1066. He was buried here in the Abbey Church on the 6th of January, 1066, and was later to be known as St. Edward the Confessor after the Pope had canonized him in 1161. And his body is still here, behind the high altar, in a beautiful shrine, surrounded by medieval kings of England, Henry III, Edward I, Edward III, Richard II, and Henry V. What then did St. Edward decide, and why did it make such a difference? When Edward the Confessor became King of England in 1042, following the death of the last Danish monarch to have ruled this country, coming from exile in his mother's Normandy, he resolved early in his reign to rebuild the Abbey and its church and to build a palace here as well. The Abbey Church and its Benedictine community had been founded around AD 960, although there may have been an earlier church and community. King Edgar had given Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury, formerly Bishop of London, a Benedictine monk, who was keen to revive Benedictine monasticism, an unpromising piece of land, an island surrounded by tributaries of the Thames, 2 miles from the city of London. This was that piece of land. There was nothing to speak of here but the quiet flowing of the river and a low-lying island. The great church Edward the Confessor built, consecrated on the 28th of December 1065, of which you will find an image in the Bayeux tapestry, was in the Romanesque, the Norman style of his mother's land. That great Norman church here, by far the greatest and finest building in the kingdom, predated the Norman conquest on the 14th of October, 1066. The key point is that Edward built his palace next door to the abbey. King Edward's motive, surely, was clear. He wished his rule of this country to be supported and buttressed and prayed for by the monks of the abbey. And he wished his abbey to have a role in forming and characterizing the state, the country he ruled. It was to be a partnership, state and church bound together, mutually supportive, together engaged in rebuilding the nation's life following the retreat of the Danes. The palace of Westminster Edward built has been through many changes over the centuries. Before the dissolution of the monastery here in 1540, Parliament met here at the Abbey, first in the chapter house and later in the monastic refectory. But those were the early days of an English Parliament, called from time to time by the king. The Palace of Westminster remains a royal palace, but since the 16th century has been referred to as the Houses of Parliament and has been occupied by Parliament. A fire almost destroyed the palace in 1834, which was then rebuilt and remodeled after the style of the Lady Chapel of Westminster Abbey, by the architect Charles Barry, who is buried here just over there in the nave. The death of Edward the Confessor on the 5th of January 1066 was followed by the brief reign of Harold II and the beginning of the reign of William the Conqueror, William I of England, and each of them was crowned here in Edward's church. Harold on the 6th of January 1066, and William the Conqueror on Christmas Day 1066. The strong relationship of mutual support between church and state was characteristic of the days of St. Edward. Sometimes the church has been dominant over the state, at other times the state over the church. Both church and state have waxed and waned, being strong at times and weak at others. One of the most remarkable moments in our country's history, a moment when the relationship between church and state was vigorously tested, was when Pope Innocent III was in profound disagreement with the English authorities. The issue in 1205 was over the appointment of a new Archbishop of Canterbury. Innocent III, who had become Pope in 1198 and reigned until 1216, had a fixed idea of who he wanted to head the church in England. John, King of England, from 1199 until 1216, had a different idea from the Pope. The Pope wished to appoint Stephen Langton as Archbishop, but the king was not content, nor were the monks of Canterbury Cathedral, who were to elect their archbishop. The Pope eventually prevailed. Pope Innocent III summoned 16 of the monks of Canterbury and ordered them to elect Stephen Langton. The Pope consecrated Langton a bishop and appointed him archbishop, and the monks of Canterbury duly elected him. But King John would not accept him and refused to allow him to come to England. He proclaimed as a public enemy anyone who recognized Langton as Archbishop. And on the 15th of July, 1207, he banned the monks from returning to Canterbury to their monastery. Pope Innocent III was determined to have his way. He responded to the king in March 1208 by placing England under an interdict. And what this interdict meant was that no services of any kind could be held within churches or parishes in England. No baptisms, no weddings, no funerals, no masses, no sacraments. The people of England were deprived of the usual daily and weekly ministries of the church, not for a week or a month, but for over 5 years. Finally, the king submitted to the authority of the Pope, and the Pope had his way. Stephen Langton came from Burgundy to claim his position and to be enthroned in Canterbury Cathedral. He was to have his revenge on the king. Working with the barons, he was to contain the power of the king with the signing of the Magna Carta. The interdict had naturally extended to Westminster Abbey, though after a time the Pope allowed the monks to celebrate a daily mass, but behind closed doors. The Abbey recognized the power of the Pope, and in 1220 agreed that the Abbot of Westminster should be directly answerable not to the Bishop of London or the Archbishop of Canterbury, but to the Pope himself, and should be appointed by him. It is probably the case that the exercise of papal authority by Innocent III was greater than that of any other pope in history. And this instance of the church commanding and controlling the state was surely unusual and unexpected. An opposite issue of the state controlling the church arose during the long reign of Edward III, who became king in 1327 and reigned for 50 years. Simon Langham was a monk of Westminster Abbey and became prior and then abbot of Westminster. He was also under the king a power in the land, as was the case with other abbots of Westminster. In 1362, he was appointed Bishop of Ely and 4 years later became Archbishop of Canterbury. During this time, the papacy was not in Rome, but in Avignon, and the Pope was French. But the king was fighting the French as part of the Hundred Years' War. And the Pope, Urban V, in 1368, offered to make Simon Langham, who was both Archbishop of Canterbury and also the Chancellor of England, a cardinal. Edward III was adamant that Langham, his archbishop, should not owe allegiance to a French pope, thus compromising his loyalty to the king and to England. Not that I have anything against the French, but you understand. He could not be the liege man of the pope in Avignon and the liege man of the king in England, one or the other. If he wished to accept the red hat of the cardinal, he must resign as archbishop, and so he did. He died in Avignon, though his remains are buried here. Cardinal Langham, having achieved through his various responsibilities and offices enormous wealth, as cardinals did in those days, left his estates to Westminster Abbey. His successor as abbot, Nicholas Littlington, was therefore able to begin again serious building work at the abbey that had been abandoned a century earlier. The nave, where we are sitting, began to be rebuilt in the style of the 13th century Abbey Church in the late 14th century and was not, in fact, completed until the beginning of the 16th century. So far, the honours are even. Church one, state one. Two further moments of major disruption between church and state can be mentioned. The first, in the early 16th century, and the second in the first half of the 17th century. The first of these was in the reign of Henry VIII, who is the best-known king to all primary children. When he came to the throne in 1509, Henry was a faithful Catholic married to a Spanish princess. In 1521, he wrote in riposte to Martin Luther, a powerful defense of the seven sacraments of the Church. The Pope approved and gave him the title Defender of the Faith. The Queen still holds that title. But his attitudes were to change as he found himself unable to father a male heir and as his eyes wandered to other possible partners. In the end, as we all know, he was to be married to six wives, two of whom he beheaded, but only to father three surviving legitimate children, each of whom went on to reign in their turn, Edward VI, Mary I, and Elizabeth I. In 1532 and over the following 2 years, the king was determined to rule in his own kingdom and not to be hampered and dominated by the Pope. The English Parliament named the king as the supreme head on earth of the Church of England. The title changed to supreme governor later, the title the Queen holds, and the Pope's authority was effectively abolished in England. Although the king's opinions wavered and were influenced by those closest to him at the time, he continued to regard himself as a Catholic. Even so, he allowed his agent, Thomas Cromwell, known as the king's vicegerent, to establish a campaign against the monastic orders in England. Cromwell had been a servant and advisor to Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, the king's great counselor for 15 years, but had then transferred his allegiance to the king. From 1534 until his downfall in 1540, Cromwell was chief advisor to the king. Perhaps his great power led to complacency. He made mistakes. He was executed. But his work had been the dissolution of all the monasteries in England. This abbey here in Westminster was dissolved in 1540 and was to become for 10 years the cathedral of a newly created diocese of Westminster, though later in 1550 it would be reamalgamated with the Diocese of London. Most of the former monasteries were destroyed and their land taken by the king or given to his friends or associates. Others, as here, were transformed into cathedrals for new dioceses. The great monastic orders, which had been highly influential religiously and culturally in England, ceased to be and have never been revived. The question has been much debated whether Cromwell's dramatic work went with or against the grain of popular public opinion. Was England ready for a Protestant Reformation, or was it happy to remain Catholic? The current opinion seems to be that Catholicism was not on the wane, but was alive and flourishing. The dissolution of the monasteries was imposed from above. A similar power later, in the time of Edward VI, imposed an English language prayer book. Queen Mary's reimposed Catholicism, perhaps lost some of its authority when she married the Spanish king. The settlement Elizabeth I eventually imposed allowed a degree of ceremony and formality and a middle way so that the English Church, the Church of England, was neither exactly Protestant nor clearly Roman Catholic, but began to be described as Catholic and Reformed. Clearly, however, in all this, the state imposed change on the church itself was comparatively supine. The second moment of disruption during the reign of Charles I, in the middle of the 17th century, was again an imposition of the state on the church. Unlike James I, who cleverly held together the various factions within the church, Charles I sought to repress the explicitly Puritan Protestant churches. This brought an inevitable reaction, which was led by Oliver Cromwell, a member of Parliament, who fought and won a civil war against the king and had him executed on the 30th of January, 1649. This led to 11 years of Commonwealth and the Protectorate, when Cromwell himself and then his son ruled. But the Puritan Church, imposed by Cromwell on the people of England, was not to their taste. After the failure of Cromwell's son Richard, the king's son returned in 1660 and reigned as Charles II with the approval of the people, who were glad to hear music again and to enjoy their familiar entertainments, which had been banned during the Commonwealth interregnum. The diarist Samuel Pepys, on the 1st of May 1660, wrote, "Today I hear they were very merry at Deal, setting up the king's flag upon one of their maypoles, and drinking his health upon their knees in the streets, and firing the guns which the soldiers of the castle threatened, but durst not oppose." On the 31st of May, 1660, Pepys wrote, "This day the month ends, I in very good health, and all the world in a merry mood because of the king's coming." So these last two moments of deep disruption and change in the life of the state during Henry VIII's reign and Charles I and II's, the church clearly see the state imposing change on the church. So the tally so far is church 1, state 3. I now turn to more recent eras, to the 19th century, and to a time of significant change for the Church of England and the other churches, and for the relationship between the state and the church. Since the Reformation, the Church of England had been regarded as the established church, the official church of the English state. As in the Middle Ages and during the time of the Tudor, Stuart, and Hanoverian monarchs, the bishops of the Church of England sat as members of the upper house of Parliament, the House of Lords. Though there were Roman Catholics and Protestant sectaries of various kinds, the Church of England was the recognized, authorized, and approved official church, and those who adhered to other religious practices were to some degree or another disapproved or actively hounded or even persecuted. But there were to be big changes during the reigns of George IV and William IV and the 17 years from the death of George III to the accession of Queen Victoria in 1837. This is slightly curious, since neither of these two sons of George III seem to have any interest at all in religion. George III had been adamant against change involving the church. Once he was dead, change was to come. And changes, again, were imposed by the state on the church. The church itself seemed entirely unprepared for these changes. The Reform Act of 1832 began the process of increasing the size of the electorate and allowing more people to choose their members of Parliament. When the bill was introduced in Parliament in 1831, 21 out of the 22 bishops present in the House of Lords voted against it. A second bill was brought before Parliament, and then a third. The reaction to these two initial failures had been violent. The spirit of the age was in favor of change, so the Archbishop of Canterbury had his coach overturned by a mob in Canterbury, and the Bishop of Bristol had his palace almost destroyed. The bill finally achieved support in both Houses of Parliament and became, with the royal assent, the Reform Act. But the bishops had been completely out of touch with the mood and wishes of the people. The state had already showed itself willing to change its attitudes to the church. Even during the reign of George III in 1791, a tentative change was agreed in relation to Catholic emancipation. Catholics would be allowed to attend their own churches, to maintain Catholic schools, and for Catholic individuals to become lawyers. Then in 1829, under the leadership of the Duke of Wellington and Robert Peel, further change was to take place. Robert Peel had been a firm opponent of Catholic emancipation, wishing to preserve inviolate the settlement of the Church of England. But there was a hot issue. Hot issues change circumstances. An Irish Catholic, Daniel O'Connell, had been elected to an Irish parliamentary seat. But as a Catholic, he was prevented from taking his seat in the House of Commons. Time and again, he came to the House of Commons. Each time, he was refused permission to swear the oath of allegiance to the Crown, and so could not take his seat. Eventually, the mood changed. Those who opposed Catholic emancipation gave up their opposition, and at last, O'Connell, and of course after him, other Roman Catholics, would be able to take up their seats in the House of Commons. Then in 1834, once again, against the will of the bishops, Robert Peel, during his 100 days first administration as Prime Minister, created an ecclesiastical commission. Large funds controlled by the bishoprics and the cathedrals would now be dispersed in order to provide parish churches in the emerging industrial towns and cities where there were no parish churches at the time, or very few. Thus, ministry would be available everywhere for the clergy in every parish receiving a modest income. And as a result of an Act of Parliament in 1836, the commission was turned into a standing body, the Ecclesiastical Commissioners. In 1948, the name was changed to Church Commissioners, and the Church Commissioners still have an important place in the Church of England. Today they control £8 billion, originally derived from funds taken from places like this, from the bishops and the cathedrals, and they use the money for the housing and financial support of the clergy. Some of you may know Anthony Trollope's novel, The Warden, written in 1855, and it gives us a curious insight into the effect on the bishops of the Church of England of the Ecclesiastical Commissioners. In his novel, Trollope contrasted the income of his fictional Bishop of Barchester with that of his successor. Bishop Grantly of Barchester was said to have received an income in the 1840s of £8,000 a year, an enormous sum of money. His successor, Bishop Proudie, his name chosen to indicate his pride and pomposity, found his income reduced, much to his wife's consternation, to £5,000 a year. And this was the impact of the Ecclesiastical Commissioners. The bishops of the Church of England didn't, however, suffer greatly as their income was reduced. In 1901, the bishop of an ordinary diocese was still paid £5,000 a year, the Archbishop of York, £10,000, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, £15,000. To point the contrast at that time, the Prime Minister received £5,000 a year, and a senior office clerk was probably in receipt of something like £150 a year. Labourers received a good deal less than £1 a week. I suppose from their stipend, the bishops had to find their own expenses. Even so, they were well rewarded for their ministry. So the tally now is more clearly in favour of the state over the church rather than the church over the state. The state has consistently imposed change on the church rather than the church achieving or imposing change on the state. Perhaps this is obvious. The state has all the power. The church's power is more subtle, applied more directly to individuals through a ministry of service. But perhaps it seems less obvious that the state should have the effect of imposing so much change unwillingly on the church. And the story of the relationship between church and state has changed dramatically in recent years. The church has become largely free in the past decades of state control. In the years after the First World War, there began a tentative move known as the Life and Liberty Movement, led among others by the wonderful William Temple, who would be Archbishop of Canterbury for 2 years before his early death in 1944, allowing the Church of England to set its own regulations and make its own decisions rather than having them made by Parliament. Parliament had rejected work undertaken by the Church of England on a revised prayer book, both in 1927 and in 1928. The Church was aggrieved and published the revised prayer book in any case. It became widely used, though unauthorized, and therefore technically unlawful. This reverse fueled a concern in the Church of England to establish its own elected governing body, bishops, clergy, and laity, coming together finally in 1970 as the General Synod of the Church of England. There's a moment in 1974 when the General Synod won the power to make its own decisions about worship and doctrine. This is really the moment when the church became free of the power of the state, though not completely. Archbishop Michael Ramsay, who'd been a curate in 1928, very distressed by the decision of Parliament, brought the matter to a culmination on the last day of his ministry as Archbishop, on the 14th of November 1974, and there have subsequently been many changes in the style and content of orders of worship in the Church of England. And the Church of England is now largely self-governing, not controlled by the state, but still strongly linked to it, most characteristically through the position of the sovereign as supreme governor of the Church of England. And the Queen opens the newly elected General Synod every 5 years, and bishops are still formally appointed by the Prime Minister. No, they are now on behalf of the Queen, though now there's an elaborate process of church-based decision-making, giving advice to the Prime Minister. The Dean and Canons of Westminster Abbey remain appointed by the monarch. Although there have been political moves for almost 200 years to separate church and state through disestablishing the Church of England, as the Church in Wales was disestablished in 1920, nevertheless, there is little political steam around the issue in current times. There was a few years ago. There have been proposals from within the church that disestablishment could free the church to be more truly itself, to be more radical, imaginative in its approach to its life and mission. However, despite discussion in recent years, 25 diocesan bishops, including the Archbishops of Canterbury and York and Bishops of London, Durham and Winchester, continue to sit as members of the House of Lords and participate in debates and votes. That surely is unique in the world. Speaking personally, I'm clear that the disestablishment of the Church of England, in other words, a radical separation between the church and the state, would neither be for the benefit of the people of our country nor for the good of the state or indeed of the church. This hate came home to me in a vivid way quite early in my time here at the Abbey. In 2007, the world marked the bicentenary of the Abolition of the Slave Trade Act. This was the Act of Parliament that had been prepared and argued for by William Wilberforce and others and abolished the British trade in slaves. It didn't, of course, effectively abolish slavery, and indeed we're conscious in our own day that slavery continues to exist. And there's a whole new movement working against slavery in the modern era, in which the Abbey happily is involved. But in March 2007, we marked the 200 years since the bill had become law, with a special service here in the Abbey, attended by the Queen and descendants of slaves and descendants of abolitionists. And it seemed to me typical in this country that we should mark an historic moment like this in church. In France, I noted, the president unveiled a statue in a Parisian park. The United Kingdom, unlike France, is not formally a secular state. It's a country in which national celebrations are in church, or at least supported by the church. Of course, the nature of British society has changed radically since the Second World War. When that war came to an end in 1945, Britain still had an empire which would evolve into a Commonwealth of Nations, many of them with the Queen as head of state. That evolution happened through a very few years, from the independence of India and Pakistan in 1947 to the independence of Ghana in 1957, followed rapidly by what the then Prime Minister Harold Macmillan called a wind of change, with nearly every country of the empire becoming a republic or a self-governing realm by the early 1960s. The Queen continues as head of the Commonwealth and will be succeeded by the Prince of Wales, and relationships continue to be warm and friendly between the Commonwealth countries and the United Kingdom, but especially focused on the presence of the Queen. And of course, this country itself has changed largely through inward migration from the Commonwealth and other countries. This began at a significant level in 1948. The depredations of the Second World War meant that the United Kingdom had a need for additional workers to sustain the life of the nation and to enable post-war recovery. People came first to work here from the West Indies, then people of Asian heritage from parts of Africa being ejected by new African governments. People came from Pakistan to work in Lancashire at a time when the British cotton industry was subject to foreign rivalry and needed to work a 24-hour day and 7-day week, though the inevitable collapse of the British cotton industry came not many years later. The need for additional manpower in this country after the war, joined with the aspirations of those arriving to work here, have led over the past 70 or so years to a British population now representing almost every nation in the world and every world faith. So there remains an important task: to enable the members of the various world faiths not simply to sit alongside one another, but actively to collaborate and cooperate for the good of all their members, and indeed for the good of the nation as a whole, as of the Commonwealth. There have been and are organizations which aim to bring faith leaders together, and some of them are deliberate attempts to do so for their own sake, and others bring faith leaders together for a particular purpose. It's been a privilege for me for some years to be part of a group of faith leaders brought together for breakfast meetings with the Metropolitan Police Commissioner. We developed a plan for how we should react in the event of a major terrorist incident in the capital city. There would be a fortnight of events culminating in a special service of commemoration here in Westminster Abbey. Amazingly quickly after the plan had been developed, an attack on the Palace of Westminster led to the death of a police officer and other victims in March 2017. The faith communities came together the next day in Trafalgar Square. Other events followed, including an occupation of Westminster Bridge, when Muslim, Christian, and other women linked hands to commemorate the victims and to model collaboration. And the service here in the Abbey, a fortnight after the event, was supported by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry, who spent time with the families of the victims and also with the first responders from the police service. At the annual Commonwealth Day service, attended by the Queen and other members of the royal family every year, prayers are said here in the Abbey from the various faith traditions. And this is a wonderful example of collaboration between the faiths, behind which are annual and more regular meetings and other occasions through the year of a similar kind. Last Tuesday, in my sermon at a celebration of the current Abbey Church's first 750 years with the Queen, I spoke of the need, as I saw it, for the government to be more consistently and positively engaged with the faith communities and to offer practical support and encouragement for their development. I saw this as a positive development of the relationship between church and state that has characterized the British system. From my long years in church education, I took one particular example, which I repeat now. 1/3 of our state-funded schools have been founded by the Church of England and the Catholic Church, and they flourish in our system of maintained education. But too many Muslim children are being educated in poorly funded independent schools. There should be a clear duty on government to encourage excellent state-funded Muslim schools. Irish immigrants in the 19th century were able to study in emerging Catholic schools. That community is fully incorporated in our society. A substantial number of state-funded Muslim schools would contribute to a similar incorporation, to mutual engagement and flourishing. In the 19th century, and through much of the 20th century, many commentators confidently predicted that religion would fade away and that people would become, autonomous, free individuals, able to make their own decisions in life, no longer haunted by the idea of a divine being controlling or manipulating people one way or the other. I express it in the terms of those opposed to religion. There are many signs, in fact, that religion and religious belief and practice continue to be alive and well. And there has been some significant growth for the many denominations and faiths that continue to offer ministry and pastoral care to their adherents and others in this country. Of course, as with the Church of England, all these denominational and faith communities must continue to have and develop their own particular character. However, the place of religion in our national life needs to be honoured and respected by the organs of the state, and where possible, to be supported and encouraged. This is particularly obvious in the close relationship between government and the religious communities over church and other faith schools, and the principle can and should be extended. In 2012, the Queen addressed this issue at an event for the 9 major world faiths at Lambeth Palace, the home of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the Queen said this, these are my final words, her words. "We should remind ourselves of the significant position of the Church of England in our nation's life. The concept of our established church is occasionally misunderstood and, I believe, commonly underappreciated. Its role is not to defend Anglicanism to the exclusion of other religions. Instead, the church has a duty to protect the free practice of all faiths in this country. It certainly provides an identity and spiritual dimension for its own many adherents, but also, gently and assuredly, the Church of England has created an environment for other faith communities, and indeed people of no faith, to live freely. Woven into the fabric of this country, the church has helped to build a better society. more and more in active cooperation for the common good with those of other faiths. So my final words, Westminster Abbey is committed to a positive engagement with the faith communities, and there are many examples of that in recent years, and we believe that that is part of our mission as clearly Anglican, clearly Christian, but representing a wider responsibility. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for a typically stimulating and authoritative canter through the natural history and potential future direction of a rather complex phenomenon. I'm sure that that will have stimulated lots of thought and questions, and we now move to the more interactive part of the evening. We have microphones around the Abbey, which will come to you if you raise your hand. Please do tell us who you are before asking your question, and it will be enormously helpful if you could keep your question concise, so that we can get as many as possible into the minutes that remain of this evening's session. So while you're cogitating on your thoughts about the speech we've just heard, I wonder whether I might ask you, John, to explore something that's been intriguing me as you've been talking, which is, on the one hand, a history as you recount it, which is predominantly about competition and often destructive competition between church and state, and yet the very positive finish to your speech, thinking about the future of both Christianity and its relationship with the state and indeed interfaith relations. How do you reconcile the two, and what are the pitfalls going forward to keep us going in the right direction rather than slumping back into some of the difficult historical tensions that you've described?
It's quite a complex question.
You have 20 minutes.
I think what I've tried to suggest is, of course, that the imposition of the state on the church has often been very positive and engaged, and the church has never, has often not been quite up to the task, frankly, of working effectively across the nation. The church has too often been rather sleepy in its engagement with the state, and the state has often therefore had to take a position for the benefit of the church. Of course, the situation over the last decades has become entirely different, with the church becoming free to govern itself, more or less, but also with this wonderful development of large faith communities beyond the Christian community. Jewish community, of course, here from the 19th century and earlier, and more recently, a very large and significant Muslim community within our country. It seems to me that it's vitally important that faiths respect one another, but do more than that, that we work together, that we find ways of positive collaboration, that the established church, and a place like this in particular, draws those of other faith communities within our national life. We've done this, for example, we had a great service on the 20th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, with largely a Muslim number of people within the Abbey. And we've done things for Kristallnacht and so on, which is the largely Jewish number of people within the Abbey communities. So we've sought to model that pattern of engaging with the various faith communities in active worship, but also on other occasions and in various ways. And it seems to me that that's a vital thing in terms of the future of our home, of a harmonious society here. And the state clearly has a role to play in more actively encouraging and supporting the faith communities, not allowing them, as it were, just to rumble on, but to engage positively together.
Thank you. Questions from the audience. I see one to the left, to my right here.
Hi there. Thank you for your talk. My name is Daniel Holland. I'm a One Young World delegate. And my question is, in the face of Brexit and rise of nationalism, how can and does the church play a role in providing an open environment for faith, like you just spoke at with the end of the talk? Thank you.
the B topic had to come up at some point this evening. I'm very glad for your question. May I take one other question and then we'll take the two together. Mohammed, right at the front here. Sorry to make you run.
I'd rather do the one by one.
Reverend Hall, thank you very much for a wonderful talk, very stimulating. The question I have is this, that with the advent of technology, especially artificial intelligence, and how that is going to dehumanize us as people, and there is a whole question about what ethics should govern the proliferation of artificial intelligence, what role can and must the church play in ensuring that the state regulates this sector and all our lives accordingly?
Thank you very much. Well, two interesting questions. As far as Brexit, I think the church has been a bit chary about Brexit. Some bishops have spoken, but essentially because our society is divided more or less equally on the issue, and therefore it's dangerous territory into which to speak. I will speak personally for myself. Although I was entirely in favor of Remain, it's gone on so long. We just need to get on with it, I think. But, I mean, who knows? We'll see what happens. I've no idea how it'll work out. It's a trying issue. And, of course, it has, in fact, dominated our national life for several years now, to the exclusion of other positive developments, to my mind. I think one of the very interesting things in answer, Hamid, to your question is that with the presence of bishops in the House of Lords, and of course many other people in the House of Lords who are thinking seriously about ethical issues, there is an opportunity for the church to have quite a positive engagement with the development of policy. And I believe personally that that is a very important and a very valuable feature of our curious state of affairs. Of course, there have been people saying, well, you shouldn't have bishops in the House of Lords. That's a ridiculous, anachronistic thing. It seems to me that it's a valuable part of the setup. I mean, in the Middle Ages, the bishops were dominant in the House of Lords. The secular peers were quite small in number, and the abbots were also members of the House of Lords. But there aren't any abbots in the House of Lords ever since the dissolution of the monasteries, of course. But it's a very fascinating thought to me that bishops are able to speak out on ethical matters in a very clear and serious way in the House of Lords. And, of course, many other people want to engage with ethical matters as well. But it's a good mix, in my view.
I saw another question at the front here. Lady in the second row, please.
Good evening. Kate Robertson, one of the two co-founders of One Young World. Fascinating back and forth between church and state. How would you today, if you can, define the limits of the power of the church in the United Kingdom?
The position of the church seems to me to be this. The Archbishop of Canterbury has... a role in national life which is recognized as authoritative, and he is able to speak, and people generally listen. They don't always agree, but that's inevitable. And the bishops in the House of Lords have their say there. On the whole, I was very moved some years ago when the Bishop of Leicester retired, and all the different faith communities in Leicester said, "This is our bishop. He is our man." And therefore, it seems to me that the church has the position to bring the faith communities together in various ways and to represent the various faith communities. So what I've suggested is that there's a sort of rumbling, rather underground sense within our national life that faith is important, that religion is important, even if you don't go to church. That there are issues which are fundamentally significant in that way, and therefore there is an opportunity for clergy sometimes to speak out on particular issues, but always guardedly, I suspect, and not too outspokenly. So it ends up you know, the risk is it ends up being a bit mealy-mouthed and less forthright than it might be. I think perhaps some people could speak out a bit more forthrightly.
I have one question here and one question over there. I wonder where the nearest microphone is, please. Take the one here first, if I may, and then I'll come to you, Peter, next.
Vasanthan Yanadas, former member of the General Synod. You mentioned a defender of the faith. Prince Charles was talking about defender of faith. What do you think of that?
Well, of course, the Latin doesn't have a definite article, so it's fidei defensor. You know, that's the Latin. So defender of faith, defender of the faith, doesn't matter at all. I think although we translate it as defender of the faith, my sense of it is that as the Queen is both a devout Anglican and a very faithful churchgoer, but also has worked very positively and engaged with those of other faiths, so I believe the Prince of Wales is, and I think he will, in the same way, want to draw the faiths together.
Peter Shaw, you said that the church and bishops in the past have been rather sort of a bit mealy-mouthed, and you were talking about being sort of cautious in what you said. With the benefit of just 2 weeks, where you can speak your mind, where do you think the church should be more radical and more outspoken?
I shouldn't have used the word mealy-mouthed, should I? That's a bit cruel. Bishops are marvellous figures. Well, I've slightly stuck my head out on this Muslim schools question, and I have been thinking about this for 20 years and been much involved in thinking about it. And I visited an independent Muslim school in North London at the invitation of someone who'd done a prayer here and taught at that school. And I was very fascinated by it because they were following the national curriculum. They were doing GCSEs. This was boys aged 11 to 16. And they were in an end-of-terrace house, crammed in, really. And it seemed to me that and they were paying a certain amount for the benefit of education there. And it seemed to me that this was not the best possible. They had good teachers, I'm sure, but the teachers were being paid very little. And if they were to benefit from an education as people have in a maintained school, they would be better off. And in terms of public policy, incorporating the Muslim community more actively with the benefit of Jewish schools, there are many Jewish schools, serving the Jewish community, but there are not many Muslim schools serving the Muslim community. Clearly, I was, for a period, Director of Education for the Diocese of Blackburn, and we had many Muslim children in our schools, and it seemed to me that it was important that we brought people together, and that was a good thing in itself, and therefore we engaged positively. But I was also very committed to the idea that a Christian in a Christian school should learn about their faith, and they should learn from that how to live positively in society. That's how the Jewish schools see themselves, and we should see that for the Muslim schools as well.
One more question at the front here, and I've got two towards the back. If someone could get the microphone to the round about the third row forward in a moment, that would be great. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dean, for your excellent talk. My name's Alan Rayner. Father B. Griffiths advised me to live the four world religions, the Abrahamic and the Hindu religion I've done. And you very kindly helped me invite Sheikh Tanner of the Muslim faith to lead a prayer group here at St. Edward's Tomb. And they were thrilled with this, and it turned out to be an international affair because many others of faiths attended. It does seem to me that the cathedrals can play a very positive role in encouraging the other faiths. But my real question is the question of the youth in the country. Because I was in 85 schools in my campaign, and I had to write to the Queen in 2005 saying that this country could no longer afford a two-tier system of education. It was £3,000 a year for a comprehensive child and over £40,000 for some of the private schools. And in the comprehensive sector, the amount of religion that was being taught was sometimes incredibly disturbing. The consequence of this to the nation is enormous. And it seems to me that with bishops in the House of Lords, this could be a real issue that they could take up. Your example of just how much Westminster Abbey has actually done.
I was very privileged to chair a commission on religious education in schools, which lasted for a couple of years. And I think we're very conscious of the fact that about a third of comprehensive schools are really doing no religious teaching at all, despite the fact there's a clear expectation that religious education will be part of the curriculum. And the report that we produced has not been seriously taken up yet, although I hope it still will be. And it seems to me it's vitally important that that children in schools learn not only about their own religion, of course, but about other religions as well, and therefore to understand other religions and to create a more cohesive society.
Thank you. The question at the back, please.
Fadia Hussein, Solicitor at Clifford Chance and a returning Ambassador at the One Young World. Thank you very much for such a fascinating speech. You mentioned that people from different religious backgrounds need to collaborate with each other. I'd like to ask you for an advice for people who are willing to collaborate. What do they need to do to ensure that their willingness is understood and welcomed by others who are from a different religious background?
Well, you can't, of course, force people to collaborate. You can't make people relate to other people. What you can do, however, is set the example for the people who do want to collaborate so that other people see the value of that and learn from it. And that it seems to me, to be the way that things should develop. It is, I mean, there is quite a considerable number of people who working together and respecting each other and engaging in dialogue together. And that seems to be the basis from which other things can, as it were, ripple out. So clearly, many people will have their own very clear faith, which they don't want to compromise in any way. And I'm not suggesting anyone should compromise their faith in any way at all, but that people should engage with each other in a way that allows mutual understanding, mutual respect to grow, and therefore mutual collaboration.
Thank you. We have time for one final question, I think. I see a hand on my left towards the back. Right there. Yeah.
Christopher Edwards. John, you are a wonderful student of history. In 1604 was held what I think was the most successful academic conference, as judged by citations, which was the Hampton Court Conference, when the king called upon 20 scholars from Oxford, 20 from Cambridge, and 20 from London, and they came together and, of course, produced the authorized version of the Bible. I wonder whether you think it's possible to catalyze another Hampton Court conference to take forward your vision of what might be achieved, in fact, actually, with these schools. I think we need something to give us a push.
Thank you, Christopher, very much. I think that is a wonderful example. We've rather under-respected James I, I think. His motto was Beati Pacifici, blessed are the peacemakers. And, of course, he came, from Scotland and in 1603 and immediately worked towards building a more cohesive society at his time with, I think, the aim of working together on the authorized version was to bring the various church communities, the different communities together. And to have it's a wonderful model, I think, of how something could be done now. And it'd be marvelous to see something worked out in a similar sort of way. There's much going on, but it's not as fully organized and developed as it might be, I think.
Thank you very much. That is about all the time that we've got. I'm sure you would want to join me in thanking the Dean for both his inspiring speech and some candid answers.